Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the program that asks you to think beyond the limitations of our daily bread and get your mind out into the world of possibilities. And so what better person to take us there than Nicholas Hager, the author of a very, very revealing book, The Syndicate. And I'll be talking about that in a minute. Before I go on to the interview with this prolific writer, I want to just say a few things. These are, number one, I hope you're keeping tabs on what's going on in the world around you. Sometimes we believe that it's better not to look. It's just too scary out there. And I remind you that every thought you put out into the universe manifests on some level. So look, see what's out there. Ask yourself what you can do to change it, to raise the vibration, and commit every day to bringing some positivity to your personal environment and to the greater world beyond you so we can improve the situation of what is around us. Okay, that's my speech for the morning. For you, morning. For me, evening. Let me introduce the wonderful Nicholas Hager, who is, as I said, a very prolific author. He was the first Westerner to witness China's Cultural Revolution and the Libyan Revolution. He has lectured at the University of Baghdad in Iraq, in Libya, Tripoli, and he's been a professor of English in Japan. Very, very knowledgeable man, author of 17 books, of which tonight we're going to speak probably more than just The Syndicate, but this is the book that I've got in my hand. It's about the story of the coming one world government, and let me just bring him in. Nicholas? Good evening, and thank you for being with me tonight.
Good evening to you.
You're over here on my side of the Atlantic, I see, in England, yeah?
That's right. I'm speaking to you from London.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for taking time to bring what I know is going to be a very exciting show to our audience. I would like to ask you, there are so many questions to ask you about this book, and to be truthful, I haven't been able to finish it because I feel like I'm back in college since I've been doing this radio show, reading, but there's just so much to absorb. So I'm going to start with a question, very general question, to ask you, what motivated you to write the book, for starters?
Okay, well, when I was in Japan, I was asked to teach a course on Gibbon, Spengler, and Toynbee. And while I was doing that, I saw a fourth way of understanding the rise and fall of civilizations. And it took me 25 years to work out the details, showing the stages that civilizations go through as they rise and fall. And while I was doing the research for that, I came across this group who basically are trying to run the world, who were trying to change the mold. I made a list of 25 civilizations, some of them dead and some of them still alive, I think 14 alive and 11 dead. And what this group wanted to do was to replace all the civilizations and have them all flowing into one world government. So when I first came across this in the 1980s, I thought, well, it's never happened before. Every civilization has a beginning, and it goes through 61 stages in the account I've given of it, and it reaches an end, and then it passes into another civilization. But here is a group trying to change all that for the first time, and so I just followed them. I didn't really take them too seriously. But I have to say that since about 1990, they've done extremely well, and the whole thing has spread. There are institutions in place that weren't in place then, and they are actually almost winning. And so that was what motivated me to write the book, because the title, The Syndicate, what is a syndicate? Well, the dictionary definition is a combination of individuals or commercial firms to promote some common interest. And those running this group that we're talking about are actually a network of families, very prominent families, very mega-rich families. But that's precisely what they're doing. It's a combination of individuals or commercial firms who are promoting a common interest, which is putting themselves in the position of being able to form a world government, which means combining America into an American Union of 34 states, including South America and Northern America. It involves combining Europe into 48 nation states as one nation, one new nation or super nation, the United States of Europe, and one Asian Pacific community in the same way, which will be a union. And those three unions are supposed to include everybody in the world. And steps are being taken all the time towards that. We're speaking on our side of the Atlantic, and you know that the reform treaty for the European Union is effectively a new constitution, and we're now at the stage that it's being ratified, and this is really putting a lot of former nation states into boxes, and combining them into this new arrangement with a view eventually to having a world government.
Yes, if they don't break us first, because the economy in the EEC has just really zapped all individual countries, I would think, with the exception of the Eastern European countries. Here in Italy, we've just been crushed by this EEC, although they portend to want us to believe that it's in the good of all countries. We, at least in Italy, have not seen this good manifest as yet.
It was to join this group that the Berlin Wall was encouraged to come down. And
Right. Certainly
Gorbachev played his part in bringing Europe together. Of course, before 1989, Eastern and Western Europe were divided. And since then, there is a chance for a chance of unity, reunification. Mm-hmm. But it's with this thinking in mind that eventually there is to be one world government and one world currency. The euro, the currency of Europe, is really a euro dollar, which is on its way to becoming a world dollar. And I think the target date is 2016. It moves around. Sometimes it falls behind. So we're talking long-termish here. We're not talking next year. Another 8 years. And as I say, it keeps falling behind, and it could well be 2020 by the time it actually properly begins to happen. But informally...
And would you agree that we won't even have an actual currency at that point, but we'll all be working with credit and debit?
Maybe.
If it is in the currency of the EU, the euro, it will still be... what I'm perceiving here is that before long we won't even be having transactions with cash.
Absolutely. And the focus is away from the nation state into being a world citizen. And at one level, this could be a brilliant thing. If those running it were really good people, what a fantastic opportunity. You could abolish war with a world government. You could abolish disease. You could abolish famine. You could give attention to all the poor everywhere, and it could be paradise. It could be a kind of heaven on earth with the right people motivating it.
I was going to say, that's the clue. It doesn't seem like these are the right people pulling the strings, does it?
But if their agenda is more self-interested, to loot the earth's resources and get the oil of the Middle East under their ownership, and so it's a more self-interested objective, then will this be of benefit to the people of the world? And that's a question I ask at the end of the book.
All right, let's start with the beginning of the book. You talk quite extensively about the Rothschild clan. And
so could you repeat that?
I say, let's go back to the beginning of the book.
Right.
You talk extensively about the Rothschild. Can you just give us an overview how they achieved such incredible wealth and triggered such a series of power mechanisms on the planet?
They were a very, very prominent family in the 19th century. They really began around 1776 as a dynasty. And they made a fortune out of the war against Napoleon, and in 1815, when Napoleon was defeated, somebody brought a message saying that Napoleon had won, and this caused a run on the Bank of England and on the assets in London, and the Rothschild family was able to pick this up incredibly cheaply, and they had five central banks in the course of the 19th century, and wanted to create a central bank in America, and were arguably behind the Civil War in the 1860s. They backed both sides, both the North and the South. But the central bank didn't happen. Lincoln intervened and prevented it from happening. And in the 20th century, the Federal Reserve System was created, principally through their dynastic help. And in those days, their protégés were the Rockefellers, and the Rockefellers were really quite small at the end of the 19th century. And John D. Rockefeller Sr. borrowed from the Rothschilds and created the railroad system. And what's happened in the 20th century has been that the Rockefellers have come up and the Rothschilds have slightly gone down. I think the Rothschilds had more money than all the crown heads of Europe put together, except for Russia in the 19th century. And they were arguably behind the first of the four revolutions in Russia, because they wanted the Russian wealth of the Tsars of Russia. And so they were behind the first revolution, and then the Rockefeller family were behind the later three revolutions.
It's pretty difficult for anyone to imagine that one family could achieve such global wealth that they could go after the Tsars and the kings, or be worth that much more than all of them combined.
The rich list is produced, and they don't appear on the rich list, but there is a case for measuring the wealth of such families in trillions, not in billions. We talk of particular people having a fortune, but dynastically, these are very, very rich people indeed. And through the connection of families, coming back to this definition of a syndicate, a combination of individuals or commercial firms to promote some common interest, a network of 15, 20 families or more, combining to create a world government project has been very effective, because they have links with all the politicians in all the countries. And if you are linked with the leaders of all the parties, then when there's an election, you're going to back a winner.
And so just divert a moment into the American panorama. A lot of people are very excited about Obama Barack and his message
right.
of change and whatever. And I've heard some interesting allusions to his contacts to certain groups. And I would like you to, if you could elaborate on who you think is backing whom in the contest for the presidency in the United States.
Well, I would think that the link between the Rothschilds and the Clintons is very historical, and so there will be support for the Clinton effort historically. But as I say, all sides are backed, and who in the world government lobby is behind McCain and who is behind Obama, time will tell. But the thing is, the world government families, this group in the syndicate, is not as unified as it would like to be. It is split. And there are factions. And so you've got, for example, different attitudes towards Palestine and Israel. You've got some who are pro-Israel, like the Rothschild family. If you remember the Churchill, the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour being the Foreign Secretary of Britain, promised the state of Israel to the then Lord Rothschild. And so the Rothschild family were around at the beginning of the creation of Israel. So clearly, that's where their allegiance lies. The Rockefellers tend to be more pro-Palestine, and so you can work things out by looking at the two. If different factions support different sides, and they're both in the same cabinet, as it were, in the same group, then you've got different emphases, and so every group is supported somewhere by a faction, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Of the syndicate. So in essence, whoever is the front man, political person for the political stage, in the end, they do answer to a higher master, which would be members of this syndicate.
Yes. I mean, if you look at our former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, whose wife is pro-Palestinian and anti-war, and the last thing she would want to do as a person is invade anywhere. What must the conversations over the breakfast table have been like when Iraq happened? Which leads one to ask, was it a free choice or was there pressure from outside?
What do you think?
I think there was pressure from outside. I think you become a president or a prime minister full of what you want to do with an agenda, and on the second day the facts of life are explained, which is, yes, you can have your money for schools and hospitals or whatever program you want, but the government's bank manager, in whatever country you are, will require you to do certain things at certain times. And if the case for going into Iraq was commercially very strong, because as the syndicate says at the beginning, the United States runs out of oil as a net producer of oil around 2007, and Britain, the North Sea oil has run virtually dry, and so both Britain and America have moved from being oil producers to being oil consumers, and Iraq has 142 years of oil under the desert sands. And there was a pipeline.
Right, Iraq is the longest lasting. At the top of your list, you indicate Iraq being the country with the longest, the greatest reserves still available, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yes. What a coincidence that they got attacked, isn't it?
That's right. And there was a pipeline from Kirkuk near Mosul to Haifa, operating in the 1930s, and this was discontinued, but my understanding is that this is being reactivated, so there is the prospect of cheap oil from Haifa eventually. It hasn't begun to happen yet, in my understanding, but it's there in the future. But again, if you fast forward to 2016, if the plan works, and it may not, these people are not all powerful, they're very, very strongly influential behind the scenes, but they have reverses and defeats. They don't automatically win every situation. Nationalists are very strong, and they are trying to move away from nationalism. But if they do succeed in moving away from nationalism to a world government, then everybody's resources everywhere are for the world. In other words, Middle Eastern oil isn't for the Middle Easterns. It's for the world, just as British fish isn't just for the British. The Spanish are allowed to send their big ships and take vast quantities because that's the new thinking.
Yeah, with maybe the new thinking of the people that manage the planet, but I don't agree that it's the new thinking of the poor people that are trying to survive what's happening. And
Absolutely. I
think there's a lot of exasperation with
Absolutely. There's a time of transition where it's very, very painful, and we're seeing everywhere a new attitude to immigration, aren't we? The movement, the migration of peoples from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, for example, which is again breaking down the old national structures and making nations into zones or states within the United States of the world, where there can be movement from one state to another. So right now, we're in a kind of transition phase from the old nationalism, nation state, to a United States of the world via regional blocs like the European Union or the American Union and the Pacific Union.
And soon to be the United Middle Eastern States of America and Israel.
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. The United...
I say it looks like, and we will soon also have the United Middle Eastern States of the
yes.
United States.
Yes. I mean, there will be regional regions in the coming world arrangement, and some of these regions may be transitional, but the United States of the Middle East is certainly a stage that they want to get to. And then, as I see it, the Middle East itself will cease to have its own identity and will merge into the world government bloc later on. But yes, a United States of the Middle East would require Iraq and Israel and Iran and various other states like the Lebanon all to exist in harmony together. And at the level of world peace, this could be wonderful if it happened, provided those who are doing it have the correct motivation. If their motivation is self-interested and they are out for themselves and it's a group of people who are cornering the world's resources and then telling everybody how little or how much they can have, that's fine. One of the worries is about population and the depopulation program that has been floated. And if you think about it, there is a desperate need. In the 1930s, there were 2 billion in the world. And in many people's lifetimes, people who've been alive since the end of the 1930s, have seen the population triple, because it's now 6 billion, with 9 billion forecast by the United Nations agencies in 2054. So, and the world's resources haven't tripled, and nor have they quadrupled, and nor will they have quadrupled by 2054. So there is a population problem, and I do see this, and I'm trying to steer a middle course and be fair to both sides. But the trouble is, there have been suggestions ever since the Rockefellers did their population studies in the 1950s. There have been suggestions that there should be a program of depopulation, which means bringing the world's population down from the level it is now to a lesser level. And this became rather confused in about 1980, when the global program was adopted by President Carter. This projected in 1980 what the population should be in 2000. And if you look very carefully at the figures, and I do deal with this in the syndicate, they don't really make for clarity. There's ambiguity at the edges, and possibly if there were a program of wars, famines, and diseases to reduce the population in accordance with this particular global program, then one could understand what's been happening, because whenever there's a local war, there are refugees, there are diseases, water's difficult, homelessness means you're exposed to insanitary conditions, and people die. And it is a way of reducing the population. And it is.
Yes.
It is wondered
I think
whether
it's so appalling
like
for
AIDS.
People to try to imagine such a format, but I think it's getting pretty clear now that the AIDS epidemic was inserted into our society.
AIDS, there is a school of thought that AIDS was man-made. I'm not saying that that's definite. Incidentally, I'm very evidential. There are 140 pages of notes and references, and I deal in facts.
Yes.
And I try not to speculate. And if I don't know, then I will say I don't know. I'm trying to deal in what I do know, which I've researched, and there's a reference store in the back of the book. But with AIDS, it is possible that it was created as part of a depopulation program. And if you think about it, you let AIDS out in Africa or in Asia, and it finds its own way. Humans don't have to have firing squads or sort of more traditional ways of reducing the population, the sort of methods that Hitler used, for example, trying to reduce the Jewish population. AIDS finds its own way, and so it may have a part in this program. And so I come back to this main theme that if those who are running the world in 2016 are well disposed and want to run it for the benefit of everybody alive, and redistribute resources to eliminate poverty and war and disease and famine and create heaven on earth, then it will have an enormous amount of support. And many people who believe in their nation state now would go along with that for the greater good of humankind. But if it's a group of sort of neo-fascist people who share some of Hitler's assumptions, who want to get the population down from 6 billion to 4 billion, or from 9 billion projected to 7 billion. It's all very nice for those who are alive, but what about those who have to die? And how do they die?
And who decide?
How do they die? And, you know, is there going to be a nuclear conflict between India and Pakistan? This global population program included a phrase, useless eaters. All those in the world who have a job and contribute to society are useful. But anybody who is unemployed, has no job, and is just a, double inverted commas, useless eater, undouble, is a candidate for being on a depopulation program. Now, there is no clear evidence that this policy is being followed, but it is known that President Carter accepted this program in 1980.
And where are you quoting from when you refer to this language of useful eaters?
Well, that's not in the program itself. It's in an accompanying document which quotes one very prominent American, and I don't want to say his name because clearly this context is, but I do know the name, somebody who's a household name and who is very old now, but and who's still alive. And it could be that that was an unfortunate phrase and had no status as part of policy. The question is, to what extent was that a paper for a discussion which was then shelved, or to what extent was it a policy that has been adopted by every president since President Carter? And the jury's out on that.
But you do believe that there is, in fact, a depopulation program on the planet working today?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Are you then stating that there is a program to depopulate the planet that's being organized by this group, the syndicate?
There have been papers written, yes, between 1955-56 and 1980. It was being looked at, and I do see the need. You know, I'm trying to be fair and see both sides. I do see the need, because you can't suddenly quadruple the world's population and not quadruple the food. It does create a problem, and it's good that people are thinking about this and trying to plan ahead, provided they're not coming up with solutions which are horrendous. The solutions may not be just to exterminate a quarter of the world's population at a particular time. There may be other solutions which are more humane and...
Well, birth control would certainly be a place to start.
Absolutely. And they've practiced that in China. Chinese citizens have been rewarded for having only one child.
Right, and yet some of the world leaders, definitely in the States, there is such an overwhelming drive against birth control.
Indeed, and this is the difficulty. As I say, they haven't got a clear run. The position is fairly confused. You have a group of people who think they know what they want to do with the world and have an enormous amount of money to see their policies into practice, an enormous amount of influence on particular world leaders. But they are not completely successful, and there are people and there are nations who want to stand apart from this direction and operate as nations. Look at what's happening in Russia at present, where there's almost a return to the Cold War against some of the policies that that followed or succeeded Gorbachev. And look at what Iran is
doing.
Do
you think that's a bad thing or a good thing?
This is a very, very good question. There are pros and cons. Pros and cons. If the group who wants to bring about a world government are well disposed to humankind, then it's a bad thing. If the group are badly connected with the people of the world, then it's a good thing that people are standing out. And I think what is happening, to take stock of where we're at in this discussion, is that people across the world are not being told the truth. And in fact, they're actively being deceived in some cases. There's being an attempt to get them into a world government, which involves loss of national sovereignty, which extends their dependence and makes them all interdependent and create an interdependent global world. But this is not being explained, and people can sense that things are not right, that there's a reduction in national sovereignty involved in the new European constitution, if it is indeed what experts have said, a constitution by another name, and not just an EU reform treaty. And people can see and question what's happening, but are baffled and bewildered because they don't really see where it's leading. But if you see where it's leading in terms of this plan to be implemented by 2016, which incidentally is the date of the last American election, because once the world government is in place, there will be no more American elections, and that is the plan.
That sounds like a good thing.
That doesn't mean it's going to happen, but that is the plan.
Well, do we really have elections anymore?
Could you repeat that? Do we really?
Do we really have elections anymore, or is it just a facade?
So, do we have a
election?
Could you repeat that word? It's a muffled line.
I'm saying, do we really believe that these are true elections, or
well,
are they just a facade?
I understand what you're saying. Increasingly, in all countries, parties are drawing together so that they're almost interchangeable. Certainly that's happened in our country, in the United Kingdom, the parties have all moved together onto the centre ground and have the same policies, and it's a competence question. And it remains to be seen how liberal or otherwise McCain is. He has a liberal record, but and it could be that he's taking the Republicans to the left, and that all three of them will be much closer together and not a real choice in the United States. Could be that that is the emerging pattern. But I agree
with
you.
Well, if indeed what you've said about the families is true, then it appears to me that whatever their rhetoric is during the campaigning, in the end, they have to push the same agenda.
Yes. Absolutely. There are emphases within the group, within the syndicate that's attempting to run the world. Different emphases, and as in a cabinet, you have some who are more to the right and some who are more to the left, and this one would prefer this policy and that one would prefer that policy. It's not completely uniform, but nevertheless, there has to be a broad area of general agreement, and all leaders need to advance the move away from nation states to world government. You can't really have a leader who is not going to advance that development.
What do you believe are the advantages to a one-world government?
I think if it's done right, then there are advantages to the citizens, because it will relieve poverty, it will give everybody more of an equal opportunity. An awful lot of people do not have clean water, so there's an effect on the poor and on citizens, and there will be a lot more mobility where movement from place to place happens. But also issues like climate change can be dealt with as one issue. But then it could be said that climate change is being pressed to try and get us to think globally to make a world government more likely. And this missile that shot down the satellite last week is another aspect to get us to think globally, that everybody is looking to outer space, to this satellite that may crash, and there is a global solution to it, which is that it should be knocked out. So it works both ways, that certainly a world government would be able to do more on climate control, because one set of laws would apply to everybody. But it could be that these issues that it's supposed to resolve are actually being created to get us there, if they are self-interested. The downside of a world government is that if you've got Hitler and Stalin in charge, then there is no refuge, and everybody is under a tyrannical setup. If you've got Hitler and Stalin in charge,
and one hopes that that would never happen. Appear that it's going that direction.
Yes, and that's why I think there is concern, and it's this concern that I tried to put in the syndicate. I'm trying to give a balanced view of saying who the syndicate are, what their aim is, how it's affecting the issues of today, including 9/11 and Iraq and so on, what the plan is, and how there are two new world orders, really. One new world order is the new world order that is good, and the other new world order is an order that, in Hitler terms, we would say was evil.
It's the perennial battle of light and darkness playing out again.
It is, absolutely. Absolutely. But I come back to the fact that the rise and fall of civilizations goes back a very, very long time, 3000 BC, and even beyond 3000 BC. So the earliest civilizations, like the Kurgan civilization of old Europe, the Indo-European Kurgans, or the ancient Egyptians or the Mesopotamians, they rose and they fell. And what I say, and my book, The Rise and Fall of Civilizations, is going to be out in about 2 weeks' time, I think. What I'm saying is that civilizations begin with a vision of light or fire. You mentioned light and darkness. For example, Muhammad has a vision in a cave of fire, and that was the first page of the Quran written in fire. So a mystic has a vision which gets passed on to a religion, and a religion forms, and people gather, come in from outside and gather in a particular place, and that religion is taken further afield, and a civilization grows, and a political unification forms around that religion. So at the beginning of the 25 civilizations I've analyzed, at the beginning, religion is very important, and they all begin with a metaphysical vision. Somebody, or a particular person, having a vision like Muhammad in his cave, long before the religion gets created around it. And so, like a rainbow, it goes up to the top of the rainbow, and then the vision turns secular, and the civilization begins to decline because it's been growing around the impetus of this particular idea. And it then falls away, and various things happen during the decay and the disintegration of a civilization, and it gets occupied and loses its identity, and in the end, it passes into another religion, as the Egyptian and the Mesopotamian civilizations passed into the Arab or Islamic civilization. So one day, people went to sleep believing in an Egyptian or Mesopotamian gods, and the next day they woke up and they were under the Islamic religion. And so there is always a civilization, wherever you are, but that particular civilization with its own identity and its own gods, a particular sun god, Ra, in Egypt, is replaced by another religion. And so that rise and fall pattern, which I've diagnosed in these civilizations, has always held for 5,000 years. And if this group has succeed, then they are going to do what nobody else has been able to do by conquest or by peaceful organization. Even the Romans couldn't do it. The Romans ruled much of the known world, but they were not able to stop this rise and fall process. The Roman Empire, at its height, is just a stage, stage 15, out of 61 stages, a quarter through. And it could be that this particular group that we're talking about is actually a group within a civilization. In other words, they are within the North American civilization, which
you
is
mean
the youngest
this, are you talking about the syndicate now?
Yes, it could be. I mean, the analogy is the Round Table. If you look at the Round Table in Britain, the Round Table were advancing the British Empire, which was a stage in the European civilization and the British experience of the European civilization. So the Round Table may have talked of ruling the world, but actually now we can see that they pressed the leaders and had discussions with the leaders and shaped policies from about 1905 to perhaps 1930s, in fact the rise of Hitler. And that is within the British civilization, within the European civilization.
Yes.
And it could be that the syndicate is American dominated. I mentioned the fact that the Rockefellers have gone up and the Rothschilds have come down in relation to the balance. Of course, the Rothschilds were extremely high during the time of the Round Table, and they were very involved in the Round Table. Until
the Round Table being a secret society in the 30s.
Yes. They were the Round Table was pro-empire. It was linked with Cecil Rhodes, who created Rhodesia. It was getting the British Empire more established and representing itself to politicians and getting the right decisions so that their program advanced. And it could be that just as the project for the New American Century, PNAC, which is behind the Americans going into Iraq. It could be that the syndicate have co-opted some European support in the Rothschilds and other families to advance the position of the North American civilization. So this is
indeed
another way.
Let me interrupt you just a moment, Nicholas, because I want to open this up to callers. If you're interested in asking Nicholas a question about what we're discussing, please check the website, see the numbers there, the toll-free numbers, and we've got some time still for you to call in and ask your question directly. The author we're speaking to, the very prolific Nicholas Hager, the book that we're speaking about at the moment is his book, The Syndicate, The Story of the Coming World Government. His website is www.nicholashager.co.uk, and you can pick up a lot of information there about all of his work. Sorry about that. I just want to get people to plugged in to so that they know who is on, because some people come in the middle of the show.
Okay.
You were talking about Iraq. I would like to take a step back from there and talk about 9/11.
Okay.
The inevitable event that really changed the world.
Okay.
Okay sounds like, okay.
I mean, the question...
What is your viewpoint of what really occurred on 9/11?
Yes, I've covered all the doubts in the syndicate, so there's a very full coverage in two chapters. And this was written nearer the time than we are now. But looking at it from now, I think the question is, to what extent did this happen as an Islamic attack? To what extent did another nation, such as Israel, find out that this attack was happening and help it forward for its own purposes? To what extent did the Americans know that the attack was about to happen and let it happen because they had their eye on Afghanistan? Or to what extent were the Americans completely taken by surprise so that nobody had the faintest idea it was coming, and everybody was genuinely shocked? And there are various positions you can have in that spectrum of questions.
It's quite dangerous to have an opinion at all these days.
Yes, we may never know. What I do know is that the First World War, the sinking of a particular ship brought in the Americans, and that sinking of that ship was known about by the British government of the day. And I also know that Pearl Harbor brought in the Americans into the Second World War, because it changed public opinion. There was such outrage. And there is evidence that the attack on Pearl Harbor was known about in advance, and people did nothing. There's definite evidence, which I do include in the book on that. And so if you want to invade Afghanistan, you can't just go to Afghanistan, you have to have a particular outrageous incident which outrages people and spurs up public feeling to support a reprisal. And
indeed,
to what extent that was at work, we don't know. And it may never be known. All one can do is ask the questions. If, just going through what I said earlier, if this was an attack by a certain Islamic extremist group. It's not all Islamics. I've been to the Arab world, and I know that not everybody feels as they do, but if a particular extremist group made war on America, then that gives 9/11 one meaning. And there is some evidence that this is the case. Israel found out that this attack was happening and kept quiet about it and actually photographed it, because it was strange that people were out with cameras happening to film holes in the road just before the first plane hit. It's very strange that it was all carried so live if nobody knew anything about it.
Yes, it was very strange.
And those cameramen... must have the award of the century for brilliant work, but nobody's ever come forward and owned up to it. It's very peculiar. The most brilliant journalistic scoop, and everybody's just scurried
underground. I would say it would be the scoop of the century.
It must best be, in a way, to be actually on the spot and to see the planes come in from all angles. It's incredibly brilliant. Sort of live coverage on the television, as it were. And if you didn't know that it was happening, it was a huge piece of luck. So I don't know. And nobody knows, really. And probably the leaders themselves don't know. Because it all happens... And if the syndicates were behind 9/11, then the president wouldn't know that it was about to happen. Because there are forces which are influenced by mega billions, which are more powerful than the political leaders. And as they're dynastic and they've been around for over 100 years actively and probably 200 years, 230 years since the beginning of this movement.
Whether they knew about it or not, it has certainly been a catalyst to move forward the agenda of the
absolutely.
One World Order.
Absolutely. It spread it's pushed the American civilization into a more imperialistic phase. So it's rather like the British Empire in certain places, not everywhere, just in certain places. And so I come back to the point that the syndicate may well be a group who are pressing for this, just as the Round Table were pressing the British to do this about 80 years ago. And so the world government may never happen. We may just have the North American civilization. It may continue as the pattern of rise and fall of civilizations always has. But when any civilization gets to stage 15, which is the stage the Roman Empire was in, then there is some group of people pressing the leaders to act like the Romans.
And what stage are we in now, according to you?
Well, the North American stage is in stage 15. The European stage is in stage 43, about to be stage 43, which is Union. Russia has, or at least the Soviet Union, has just come out of stage 43 because stage 46 is a federal stage. And so the Communist Union has ended, and we've now got federalism in the USSR. Incidentally, I predicted that would happen in the course of first stating this theory. So the fact that it got the move away from communism to a federal arrangement right in the early statement of this particular view must mean that it's got something going for it.
Indeed. It's very interesting seeing what's playing out with Russia now. I think we need to keep our eyes on that. Those developments and watching what Putin is going to do next as all of this evolves. Nicholas, we are already at the end of our time. Can you believe that?
I've enjoyed this, and thank you very much for...
I've enjoyed it too, and I am very grateful, and I hope you'll come back on and share some of your other work with us at another date.
Be pleased to. Patricia,
okay, everybody, this is saying goodnight to Nicholas Hager, the author of The Syndicate. Please check him out. This book is very powerful. As he said, he tries to give a very balanced viewpoint of what he perceives as the development of the New World Order. It's a beautiful book, and I really recommend it. And it's time to say goodnight. Don't forget, please check my site, www.syrianrevelations.net. My books have another slant on what's happening, if those of you who have read them know. Quite a little bit more out there, I guess, but nonetheless, right on the same track. So, thanks again, Nicholas. I will talk to you again soon, I hope. And to everyone, please give a lot of thought to what you've heard tonight and search, search, search to make meaning out of what's going on in the world, because you are the world, and your opinion and your wisdom and your sense of knowing changes the tape. You can affect the world. So that, like Nicholas says, it can be for the highest good, and we can have a one-world order of peace around this planet. Good night, everybody. I will see you again on Sunday. And good night again, Nicholas. I hope to have you back soon.
Thank you.